Things Fall Apart, Disc 4.
Chapter 12. On the following morning, the entire neighborhood wore a festive air because Okonkwo's friend, Obierika, was celebrating his daughter's Uri. It was the day on which her suitor, having already paid the greater part of her bride price, would bring palm wine not only to her parents and immediate relatives, but to the wide and extensive group of kinsmen called Umuna. Everybody had been invited, men, women, and children. But it was really a woman's ceremony, and the central figures were the bride and her mother. As soon as day broke, breakfast was hastily eaten, and women and children began to gather at Obierika's compound to help the bride's mother in her difficult but happy task of cooking for a whole village. Okonkwo's family was astir like any other family in the neighborhood. Nwoye's mother and Okonkwo's youngest wife were ready to set out for Obierika's compound with all their children. Nwoye's mother carried a basket of cocoa yams, a cake of salt, and smoked fish, which she would present to Obierika's wife. Okonkwo's youngest wife, Ojiugo, also had a basket of plantains and cocoa yams, and a small pot of palm oil. The children carried pots of water. Ekwefi was tired and sleepy from the exhausting experiences of the previous night. It was not very long since they had returned. The priestess, with Ezinma sleeping on her back, had crawled out of the shrine on her belly like a snake. She had not as much as looked at Okonkwo and Ekwefi, or shown any surprise at finding them at the mouth of the cave. She looked straight ahead of her and walked back to the village. Okonkwo and his wife followed at a respectful distance. They thought the priestess might be going to her house, but she went to Okonkwo's compound, passed through his obi, and into Ekwefi's hut, and walked into her bedroom. She placed Ezinma carefully on the bed and went away without saying a word to anybody. Ezinma was still sleeping when everyone else was astir, and Ekwefi asked Nwoye's mother and Ojiugo to explain to Obierika's wife that she would be late. She had got ready her basket of cocoa yams and fish, but she must wait for Ezinma to wake.
"You need some sleep yourself," said Nwoye's mother. "You look very tired."
As they spoke, Ezinma emerged from the hut, rubbing her eyes and stretching her spare frame. She saw the other children with their water pots and remembered that they were going to fetch water for Obierika's wife. She went back to the hut and brought her pot.
"Have you slept enough?" asked her mother.
"Yes," she replied. "Let us go."
"Not before you have had your breakfast," said Ekwefi. And she went into her hut to warm the vegetable soup she had cooked last night.
"We shall be going," said Nwoye's mother. "I will tell Obierika's wife that you are coming later."
And so they all went to help Obierika's wife. Nwoye's mother, with her four children, and Ojiugo, with her too. As they trooped through Okonkwo's obi, he asked,
"Who will prepare my afternoon meal?"
"I shall return to do it," said Ojiugo.
Okonkwo was also feeling tired and sleepy, for although nobody else knew it, he had not slept at all last night. He had felt very anxious, but did not show it. When Ekwefi had followed the priestess, he had allowed what he regarded as a reasonable and manly interval to pass, and then gone with his machete to the shrine where he thought they must be. It was only when he had got there that it had occurred to him that the priestess might have chosen to go round the villages first. Okonkwo had returned home and sat waiting. When he thought he had waited long enough,
he again returned to the shrine. But the hills and the caves were as silent as death. It was only on his fourth trip that he had found Ekwefi, and by then he had become gravely worried. Obierica's compound was as busy as an anthill. Temporary cooking tripods were erected on every available space by bringing together three blocks of sun-dried earth and making a fire in their midst. Cooking pots went up and down the tripods, and fufu was pounded in 100 wooden mortars. Some of the women cooked the yams and the cassava, and others prepared vegetable soup. Young men pounded the fufu or split firewood. The children made endless trips to the stream. Three young men helped Obierica to slaughter the two goats with which the soup was made. They were very fat goats, but the fattest of all was tethered to a peg near the wall of the compound. It was as big as a small cow. Obierica had sent one of his relatives all the way to Umwike to buy that goat. It was the one he would present alive to his in-laws. "The market of Umwike is a wonderful place," said the young man who had been sent by Obierica to buy the giant goat. "There are so many people on it that if you threw up a grain of sand, it would not find a way to fall to earth again." "It is the result of a great medicine," said Obierica. "The people of Umwike wanted their market to grow and swallow up the markets of their neighbors, so they made a powerful medicine. Every market day, before the first cock crow, this medicine stands on the market ground in the shape of an old woman with a fan. With this magic fan, she beckons to the market all the neighboring clans. She beckons in front of her, and behind her, to her right, and to her left. And so everybody comes," said another man. "Honest men and thieves. They can steal your cloth from off your waist in that market." "Yes," said Obierica. "I warned Nwankwo to keep a sharp eye and a sharp ear. There was once a man who went to sell a goat. He led it on a thick rope, which he tied round his wrist. But as he walked through the market, he realized that people were pointing at him, as they do to a madman. He could not understand it, until he looked back and saw that what he led at the end of the tether was not a goat, but a heavy log of wood. "Do you think a thief can do that kind of thing single-handed?" asked Nwankwo. "No," said Obierica. "They use medicine." When they had cut the goats' throats and collected the blood in a bowl, they held them over an open fire to burn off the hair, and the smell of burning hair blended with the smell of cooking. Then they washed them and cut them up for the women who prepared the soup. All this anthill activity was going smoothly when a sudden interruption came. It was a cry in the distance. "Oji odu achu ijijio," the one that uses its tail to drive flies away. Every woman immediately abandoned whatever she was doing and rushed out in the direction of the cry. "We cannot all rush out like that, leaving what we are cooking to burn in the fire," shouted Chielo, the priestess. "Three or four of us should stay behind." "It is true," said another woman. "We will allow three or four women to stay behind." Five women stayed behind to look after the cooking pots, and all the rest rushed away to see the cow that had been let loose. When they saw it, they drove it back to its owner, who at once paid the heavy fine which the village imposed on anyone whose cow was let loose on his neighbor's crops. When the women had exacted the penalty, they checked among themselves to see if any woman had failed to come out when the cry had been raised. "Where is Mugbogo?" asked one of them. "She is ill in bed," said Mugbogo's next-door neighbor. "She is Iba."
The only other person is Udenko, said another woman, and her child is not 28 days yet. Those women whom Obierica's wife had not asked to help her with the cooking returned to their homes, and the rest went back in a body to Obierica's compound.
Whose cow was it?
Asked the women who had been allowed to stay behind.
It was my husband's, said Eze Logbo. One of the young children had opened the gate of the cowshed.
Early in the afternoon, the first two pots of palm wine arrived from Obierica's in-laws. They were duly presented to the women, who drank a cup or two each to help them in their cooking. Some of it also went to the bride and her attendant maidens, who were putting the last delicate touches of razor to her coiffure and camwood on her smooth skin. When the heat of the sun began to soften, Obierica's son, Maduka, took a long broom and swept the ground in front of his father's obi. And as if they had been waiting for that, Obierica's relatives and friends began to arrive, every man with his goatskin bag hung on one shoulder and a rolled goatskin mat under his arm. Some of them were accompanied by their sons bearing carved wooden stools. Okonkwo was one of them. They sat in a half circle and began to talk of many things. It would not be long before the suitors came. Okonkwo brought out his snuff bottle and offered it to Ogbwefi Ezenwa, who sat next to him. Ezenwa took it, tapped it on his kneecap, rubbed his left palm on his body to dry it before tipping a little snuff into it. His actions were deliberate, and he spoke as he performed them.
I hope our in-laws will bring many pots of wine. Although they come from a village that is known for being close-fisted, they ought to know that a Kweke is the bride for a king.
They dare not bring fewer than 30 pots, said Okonkwo. I shall tell them my mind if they do.
At that moment, Obierica's son, Maduka, led out the giant goat from the inner compound for his father's relatives to see. They all admired it and said that that was the way things should be done. The goat was then led back to the inner compound. Very soon after, the in-laws began to arrive. Young men and boys in single file, each carrying a pot of wine, came first. Obierica's relatives counted the pots as they came. 20? 25? There was a long break, and the hosts looked at each other as if to say, I told you. Then more pots came. 30. 35. 40. 45. The hosts nodded in approval and seemed to say, Now they are behaving like men. Altogether, there were 50 pots of wine. After the pot bearers came Ibe, the suitor, and the elders of his family. They sat in a half moon, thus completing a circle with their hosts. The pots of wine stood in their midst. Then the bride, her mother, and a half dozen other women and girls emerged from the inner compound and went round the circle, shaking hands with all. The bride's mother led the way, followed by the bride and the other women. The married women wore their best clothes, and the girls wore red and black waist beads and anklets of brass. When the women retired, Obierica presented kola nuts to his in-laws. His eldest brother broke the first one.
Life to all of us, he said as he broke it, and let there be friendship between your family and ours. The crowd answered, Ay, ay, ay! We are giving you our daughter today. She will be a good wife to you. She will bear you 9 sons, like the mother of our town.
Ay, ay, ay!
the oldest man in the camp of the visitors, replied, "It will be good for you, and it will be good for us."
"Hey, hey, hey!"
"This is not the first time my people have come to marry your daughter. My mother was one of you."
"Hey, hey, hey!"
"And this will not be the last, because you understand us, and we understand you. You are a great family."
"Hey, hey, hey!"
"Prosperous men and great warriors." He looked in the direction of Okonkwo. "Your daughter will bear us sons like you."
"Hey, hey, hey!"
The cola was eaten, and the drinking of palm wine began. Groups of 4 or 5 men sat round with a pot in their midst. As the evening wore on, food was presented to the guests. There were huge bowls of fufu and steaming pots of soup. There were also pots of yam pottage. It was a great feast. As night fell, burning torches were set on wooden tripods, and the young men raised a song. The elders sat in a big circle, and the singers went round singing each man's praise as they came before him. They had something to say for every man. Some were great farmers. Some were orators who spoke for the clan. Okonkwo was the greatest wrestler and warrior alive. When they had gone round the circle, they settled down in the center, and girls came from the inner compound to dance. At first, the bride was not among them. But when she finally appeared, holding a cock in her right hand, a loud cheer rose from the crowd. All the other dancers made way for her. She presented the cock to the musicians and began to dance. Her brass anklets rattled as she danced, and her body gleamed with camwood in the soft yellow light. The musicians, with their wood, clay, and metal instruments, went from song to song, and they were all gay. They sang the latest song in the village. "If I hold her hand, she says, don't touch. If I hold her foot, she says, don't touch. But when I hold her waist beads, she pretends not to know." The night was already far spent when the guests rose to go, taking their bride home to spend 7 market weeks with her suitor's family. They sang songs as they went, and on their way they paid short courtesy visits to prominent men, like Okonkwo, before they finally left for their village. Okonkwo made a present of 2 cocks to them. Chapter 13. Go dee dee go go dee go. Dee go go dee go. It was the Ekwe talking to the clan. One of the things every man learned was the language of the hollowed out wooden instrument. Deem, 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 boomed the cannon at intervals. The first cock had not crowed, and Umwofia was still swallowed up in sleep and silence when the Ekwe began to talk, and the cannon shattered the silence. Men stirred on their bamboo beds and listened anxiously. Somebody was dead. The cannon seemed to rend the sky. "Digogo, digo, didigogo," floated in the message-laden night air. The faint and distant wailing of women settled like a sediment of sorrow on the earth. Now and again, a full-chested lamentation rose above the wailing whenever a man came into the place of death. He raised his voice once or twice in manly sorrow, and then sat down with the other men, listening to the endless wailing of the women and the esoteric language of the Ekwe. Now and again the cannon boomed. The wailing of the women would not be heard beyond the village, but the Ekwe carried the news to all the 9 villages and even beyond. It began by naming the clan.
Umofia Obodo Dike, the land of the brave. Umofia Obodo Dike, Umofia Obodo Dike. It said this over and over again, and as it dwelt on it, anxiety mounted in every heart that heaved on a bamboo bed that night. Then it went nearer and named the village. Igwedo, of the yellow grinding stone. It was Okonkwo's village. Again and again, Igwedo was called, and men waited breathlessly in all the 9 villages. At last, the man was named, and the people sighed. Eu, Ezeudu is dead. A cold shiver ran down Okonkwo's back as he remembered the last time the old man had visited him. That boy calls you father, he had said. Bear no hand in his death. Ezeudu was a great man, and so all the clan was at his funeral. The ancient drums of death beat, guns and cannon were fired, and men dashed about in frenzy, cutting down every tree or animal they saw, jumping over walls, and dancing on the roof. It was a warrior's funeral. And from morning till night, warriors came and went in their age groups. They all wore smoked raffia skirts, and their bodies were painted with chalk and charcoal. Now and again, an ancestral spirit, or a gugu, appeared from the underworld, speaking in a tremulous, unearthly voice, and completely covered in raffia. Some of them were very violent, and there had been a mad rush for shelter earlier in the day, when one appeared with a sharp machete, and was only prevented from doing serious harm by 2 men who restrained him with the help of a strong rope tied round his waist. Sometimes he turned round and chased those men, and they ran for their lives, but they always returned to the long rope he trailed behind. He sang in a terrifying voice that a kwensu, or evil spirit, had entered his eye. But the most dreaded of all was yet to come. He was always alone, and was shaped like a coffin. A sickly odor hung in the air wherever he went, and flies went with him. Even the greatest medicine men took shelter when he was near. Many years ago, another Egwugu had dared to stand his ground before him, and had been transfixed to the spot for 2 days. This one had only 1 hand, and it carried a basket full of water. But some of the Egwugu were quite harmless. One of them was so old and infirm that he leaned heavily on a stick. He walked unsteadily to the place where the corpse was laid, gazed at it a while, and went away again to the underworld. The land of the living was not far removed from the domain of the ancestors. There was coming and going between them, especially at festivals, and also when an old man died, because an old man was very close to the ancestors. A man's life, from birth to death, was a series of transition rites which brought him nearer and nearer to his ancestors. Ezeudu had been the oldest man in his village, and at his death there were only 3 men in the whole clan who were older, and 4 or 5 others in his own age group. Whenever one of these ancient men appeared in the crowd to dance unsteadily the funeral steps of the tribe, younger men gave way, and the tumult subsided. It was a great funeral, such as befitted a noble warrior. As the evening drew near, the shouting and the firing of guns, the beating of drums, and the brandishing and clanging of machetes increased. Ezeudu had taken 3 titles in his life. It was a rare achievement. There were only 4 titles in the clan, and only 1 or 2 men in any generation ever achieved the 4th and highest. When they did, they became the lords of the land. Because he had taken titles, Ezeudu was to be buried after dark, with only a glowing brand to light the sacred ceremony. But before this quiet and final rite, the tumult increased tenfold. Drums beat violently, and men leaped up and down in frenzy. Guns were fired on all sides, and sparks flew out as machetes clanged together in warriors' salutes. The air was full of dust and the smell of gunpowder. It was then that the one-handed spirit came, carrying a basket full of water. People made way for him on all sides, and the noise subsided. Even the smell of gunpowder was swallowed in the sickly smell that now filled the air. He danced a few steps to the funeral drums, and then went to see the corpse.
Ezeudu, he called in his guttural voice. If you had been poor in your last life, I would have asked you to be rich when you come again. But you were rich. If you had been a coward, I would have asked you to bring courage. But you were a fearless warrior. If you had died young, I would have asked you to get life. But you lived long. So I shall ask you to come again, the way you came before. If your death was the death of nature, go in peace. But if a man caused it, do not allow him a moment's rest.
He danced a few more steps and went away. The drums and the dancing began again and reached fever heat. Darkness was around the corner, and the burial was near. Guns fired the last salute, and the cannon rent the sky. And then from the center of the delirious fury came a cry of agony and shouts of horror. It was as if a spell had been cast. All was silent. In the center of the crowd, a boy lay in a pool of blood. It was the dead man's 16-year-old son, who with his brothers and half-brothers had been dancing the traditional farewell to their father. Okonkwo's gun had exploded, and a piece of iron had pierced the boy's heart. The confusion that followed was without parallel in the tradition of Umwofia. Violent deaths were frequent, but nothing like this had ever happened. The only course open to Okonkwo was to flee from the clan. It was a crime against the Earth Goddess to kill a clansman, and a man who committed it must flee from the land. The crime was of two kinds, male and female. Okonkwo had committed the female because it had been inadvertent. He could return to the clan after 7 years. That night, he collected his most valuable belongings into headloads. His wives wept bitterly, and their children wept with them, without knowing why. Obierica and a half-dozen other friends came to help and to console him. They each made 9 or 10 trips, carrying Okonkwo's yams to store in Obierica's barn. And before the cock crowed, Okonkwo and his family were fleeing to his motherland. It was a little village called Mbanta, just beyond the borders of Mbaino. As soon as the day broke, a large crowd of men from Ezeudu's quarter stormed Okonkwo's compound, dressed in garbs of war. They set fire to his houses, demolished his red walls, killed his animals, and destroyed his barn. It was the justice of the Earth Goddess, and they were merely her messengers. They had no hatred in their hearts against Okonkwo. His greatest friend, Obierica, was among them. They were merely cleansing the land, which Okonkwo had polluted with the blood of a clansman. Obiarica was a man who thought about things. When the will of the goddess had been done, he sat down in his obi and mourned his friend's calamity. Why should a man suffer so grievously for an offense he had committed inadvertently? But although he thought for a long time, he found no answer. He was merely led into greater complexities. He remembered his wife's twin children, whom he had thrown away. What crime had they committed? The earth had decreed that they were an offense on the land and must be destroyed. And if the clan did not exact punishment for an offense against the great goddess, her wrath was loosed on all the land and not just on the offender. As the elders said, if one finger brought oil, it soiled the others. Part 2. Chapter 14. Okonkwo was well received by his mother's kinsmen in Mbanta. The old man who received him was his mother's younger brother, who was now the eldest surviving member of that family. His name was Uchendu, and it was he who had received Okonkwo's mother 20 and 10 years before, when she had been brought home from Umofia to be buried with her people. Okonkwo was only a boy then, and Uchendu still remembered him crying the traditional farewell. Mother, mother, mother is going. That was many years ago. Today, Okonkwo was not bringing his mother home to be buried with her people. He was taking his family, of 3 wives and their children, to seek refuge in his motherland. As soon as Uchendu saw him with his sad and weary company, he guessed what had happened and asked no questions. It was not until the following day that Okonkwo told him the full story. The old man listened silently to the end and then said with some relief, "It is a female Ochu." And he arranged the requisite rites and sacrifices. Okonkwo was given a plot of ground on which to build his compound and 2 or 3 pieces of land on which to farm during the coming planting season. With the help of his mother's kinsmen, he built himself an obi and 3 huts for his wives. He then installed his personal god and the symbols of his departed fathers. Each of Uchendu's 5 sons contributed 300 seed yams to enable their cousin to plant a farm, for as soon as the first rain came, farming would begin. At last the rain came. It was sudden and tremendous. For 2 or 3 moons the sun had been gathering strength till it seemed to breathe a breath of fire on the earth. All the grass had long been scorched brown, and the sands felt like live coals to the feet. Evergreen trees wore a dusty coat of brown. The birds were silenced in the forests, and the world lay panting under the live, vibrating heat. And then came the clap of thunder. It was an angry, metallic, and thirsty clap, unlike the deep and liquid rumbling of the rainy season. A mighty wind arose and filled the air with dust. Palm trees swayed as the wind combed their leaves into flying crests like strange and fantastic coiffure. When the rain finally came, it was in large, solid drops of frozen water, which the people called the nuts of the water of heaven. They were hard and painful on the body as they fell, yet young people ran about happily, picking up the cold nuts and throwing them into their mouths to melt. The earth quickly came to life, and the birds in the forests fluttered around and chirped merrily. A vague scent of life and green vegetation was diffused in the air. As the rain began to fall more soberly and in smaller liquid drops, children sought for shelter, and all were happy, refreshed, and thankful.
Okonkwo and his family worked very hard to plant a new farm. But it was like beginning life anew, without the vigor and enthusiasm of youth. Like learning to become left-handed in old age. Work no longer had for him the pleasure it used to have. And when there was no work to do, he sat in a silent half-sleep. His life had been ruled by a great passion, to become one of the lords of the clan. That had been his life spring, and he had all but achieved it. Then, everything had been broken. He had been cast out of his clan, like a fish onto a dry, sandy beach, panting. Clearly his personal god, or chi, was not made for great things. A man could not rise beyond the destiny of his chi. The saying of the elders was not true, that if a man said yea, his chi also affirmed. Here was a man whose chi said nay, despite his own affirmation. The old man, Uchendu, saw clearly that Okonkwo had yielded to despair, and he was greatly troubled. He would speak to him after the Isa Ifi ceremony. The youngest of Uchendu's five sons, Amiku, was marrying a new wife. The bride price had been paid, and all but the last ceremony had been performed. Amiku and his people had taken palm wine to the bride's kinsmen about 2 moons before Okonkwo's arrival in Mbanta. And so it was time for the final ceremony of confession. The daughters of the family were all there, some of them having come a long way from their homes in distant villages. Uchendu's eldest daughter had come from Obodo, nearly half a day's journey away. The daughters of Uchendu's brothers were also there. It was a full gathering of Umwada, in the same way as they would meet if a death occurred in the family. There were 22 of them. They sat in a big circle on the ground, and the bride sat in the center, with a hen in her right hand. Uchendu sat by her, holding the ancestral staff of the family. All the other men stood outside the circle, watching. Their wives watched also. It was evening, and the sun was setting. Uchendu's eldest daughter, Njide, asked the questions. Remember that if you do not answer truthfully, you will suffer or even die at childbirth, she began. How many men have lain with you since my brother first expressed the desire to marry you? None, she answered simply. Answer truthfully, urged the other women. None? Asked Njide. None, she answered. Swear on this staff of my father's, said Uchendu. I swear, said the bride. Uchendu took the hen from her, slit its throat with a sharp knife, and allowed some of the blood to fall on his ancestral staff. From that day, Amiku took the young bride to his hut, and she became his wife. The daughters of the family did not return to their homes immediately, but spent 2 or 3 days with their kinsmen. On the second day, Uchendu called together his sons and daughters and his nephew, Okonkwo. The men brought their goatskin mats, with which they sat on the floor, and the women sat on a sisal mat spread on a raised bank of earth. Uchendu pulled gently at his gray beard and gnashed his teeth. Then he began to speak, quietly and deliberately, picking his words with great care. It is Okonkwo that I primarily wish to speak to, he began. But I want all of you to note what I am going to say. I am an old man, and you are all children. I know more about the world than any of you. If there is anyone among you who thinks he knows more, let him speak up. He paused, but no one spoke.
Why is Okonkwo with us today? This is not his clan. We are only his mother's kinsmen. He does not belong here. He is an exile, condemned for 7 years to live in a strange land. And so he is bowed with grief. But there is just one question I would like to ask him. Can you tell me, Okonkwo, why it is that one of the commonest names we give our children is Ineka, or Mother is Supreme? We all know that a man is the head of the family, and his wives do his bidding. A child belongs to its father and his family, and not to its mother and her family. A man belongs to his fatherland, and not to his motherland. And yet we say, Ineka, Mother is Supreme. Why is that? There was a silence. I want Okonkwo to answer me, said Uchendu.
I do not know the answer, Okonkwo replied.
You do not know the answer? So you see that you are a child. You have many wives and many children, more children than I have. You are a great man in your clan, but you are still a child, my child. Listen to me, and I shall tell you. But there is one more question I shall ask you. Why is it that when a woman dies, she is taken home to be buried with her own kinsmen? She is not buried with her husband's kinsmen. Why is that? Your mother was brought home to me and buried with my people. Why was that?
Okonkwo shook his head. He does not know that either, said Uchendu. And yet he is full of sorrow because he has to come live in his motherland for a few years. He laughed a mirthless laugh and turned to his sons and daughters. What about you? Can you answer my question? They all shook their heads. Then listen to me, he said, and cleared his throat. It's true that a child belongs to its father. But when a father beats his child, it seeks sympathy in its mother's hut. A man belongs to his fatherland when things are good and life is sweet. But when there is sorrow and bitterness, he finds refuge in his motherland. Your mother is there to protect you. She is buried there. And that is why we say that Mother is Supreme. Is it right that you, Okonkwo, should bring to your mother a heavy face and refuse to be comforted? Be careful, or you may displease the dead. Your duty is to comfort your wives and children and take them back to your fatherland after 7 years. But if you allow sorrow to weigh you down and kill you, they will all die in exile. He paused for a long while. These are now your kinsmen. He waved at his sons and daughters. You think you are the greatest sufferer in the world? Do you know that men are sometimes banished for life? Do you know that men sometimes lose all their yams and even their children? I had 6 wives once. I have none now, except that young girl who knows not her right from her left. Do you know how many children I have buried? Children I begot in my youth and strength. 22. I did not hang myself, and I am still alive. If you think you are the greatest sufferer in the world, ask my daughter, Akweni, how many twins she has borne and thrown away. Have you not heard the song they sing when a woman dies? For whom is it well? For whom is it well?
There is no one for whom it is well. I have no more to say to you. Chapter 15. It was in the second year of Okonkwo's exile that his friend, Obiereka, came to visit him. He brought with him two young men, each of them carrying a heavy bag on his head. Okonkwo helped them put down their loads. It was clear that the bags were full of cowries. Okonkwo was very happy to receive his friend. His wives and children were very happy too, and so were his cousins and their wives, when he sent for them and told them who his guest was.
"You must take him to salute our father," said one of the cousins.
"Yes," replied Okonkwo, "we are going directly." But before they went, he whispered something to his first wife. She nodded, and soon the children were chasing one of their cocks. Uchendu had been told by one of his grandchildren that three strangers had come to Okonkwo's house. He was therefore waiting to receive them. He held out his hands to them when they came into his obi, and after they had shaken hands, he asked Okonkwo who they were.
"This is Obiereka, my great friend. I have already spoken to you about him."
"Yes," said the old man, turning to Obiereka. "My son has told me about you, and I am happy you have come to see us. I knew your father, Iweka. He was a great man. He had many friends here, and came to see them quite often. Those were good days, when a man had friends in distant clans. Your generation does not know that. You stay at home, afraid of your next-door neighbor. Even a man's motherland is strange to him nowadays." He looked at Okonkwo.
"I am an old man, and I like to talk. That is all I am good for now."
He got up painfully, went into an inner room, and came back with a kola nut.
"Who are the young men with you?" he asked as he sat down again on his goatskin.
Okonkwo told him.
"Ah," he said, "welcome, my sons."
He presented the kola nut to them, and when they had seen it and thanked him, he broke it, and they ate.
"Go into that room," he said to Okonkwo, pointing with his finger. "You will find a pot of wine there."
Okonkwo brought the wine, and they began to drink. It was a day old, and very strong.
"Yes," said Uchendu after a long silence. "People traveled more in those days. There is not a single clan in these parts that I do not know very well. Aninta, Umuazu, Ikeocha, Ilumelu, Abame, I know them all."
"Have you heard," asked Obiereka, "that Abame is no more?"
"How is that?"
asked Uchendu and Okonkwo together.
"Abame has been wiped out," said Obiereka. "It is a strange and terrible story. If I had not seen the few survivors with my own eyes and heard their story with my own ears, I would not have believed. Was it not on an Eke day that they fled into Umofia?" he asked his two companions, and they nodded their heads.
3 moons ago," said Obiereka, "on an Eke market day, a little band of fugitives came into our town. Most of them were sons of our land, whose mothers had been buried with us. But there were some, too, who came because they had friends in our town, and others who could think of nowhere else open to escape. And so they fled into Umofia with a woeful story."
He drank his palm wine, and Okonkwo filled his horn again. He continued,
During the last planting season, a white man had appeared in their clan.
An albino, suggested Okonkwo.
He was not an albino. He was quite different. He sipped his wine. And he was riding an iron horse.
The first people who saw him ran away, but he stood beckoning to them.
In the end, the fearless ones went near and even touched him. The elders consulted their oracle, and it told them that the strange man would break their clan and spread destruction among them.
Obierica again drank a little of his wine.
And so they killed the white man and tied his iron horse to their sacred tree, because it looked as if it would run away to call the man's friends. I forgot to tell you another thing which the oracle said. It said that other white men were on their way. They were locusts, it said, and that first man was their harbinger, sent to explore the terrain, and so they killed him.
What did the white man say before they killed him? Asked Uchendu.
He said nothing, answered one of Obierica's companions.
He said something, only they did not understand him, said Obierica. He seemed to speak through his nose. One of the men told me, said Obierica's other companion, that he repeated over and over again a word that resembled Mbaino. Perhaps he had been going to Mbaino and had lost his way.
Anyway, resumed Obierica, they killed him and tied up his iron horse. This was before the planting season began. For a long time nothing happened. The rains had come and yams had been sown. The iron horse was still tied to the sacred silk cotton tree. And then one morning, three white men, led by a band of ordinary men like us, came to the clan. They saw the iron horse and went away again. Most of the men and women of Abame had gone to their farms. Only a few of them saw these white men and their followers. For many market weeks, nothing else happened. They have a big market in Abame on every other Afo day, and, as you know, the whole clan gathers there. That was the day it happened. The three white men and a very large number of other men surrounded the market. They must have used a powerful medicine to make themselves invisible until the market was full, and they began to shoot. Everybody was killed, except the old and the sick, who were at home, and a handful of men and women whose chi were wide awake and brought them out of that market. He paused. Their clan is now completely empty. Even the sacred fish in their mysterious lake have fled, and the lake has turned the color of blood. A great evil has come upon their land, as the oracle had warned. There was a long silence. Uchendu ground his teeth together audibly. Then he burst out. Never kill a man who says nothing. Those men of Abame were fools. What did they know about the man?
He ground his teeth again and told a story to illustrate his point.
Mother Kite once sent her daughter to bring food. She went and brought back a duckling.
You have done very well, said Mother Kite to her daughter. But tell me, what did the mother of this duckling say when you swooped and carried its child away?
It said nothing, replied the young kite. It just walked away.
You must return the duckling, said Mother Kite. There is something ominous behind the silence.
And so Daughter Kite returned the duckling and took a chick instead.
What did the mother of this chick do? Asked the old kite.
It cried and raved and cursed me, said the young kite.
Then we can eat the chick, said her mother.
There is nothing to fear from someone who shouts. Those men of Abame were fools.
They were fools, said Okonkwo after a pause. They had been warned that danger was ahead. They should have armed themselves with their guns and their machetes, even when they went to market.
They have paid for their foolishness, said Obierica. But I am greatly afraid. We have heard stories about white men who made the powerful guns and the strong drinks and took slaves away across the seas, but no one thought the stories were true.
There is no story that is not true, said Uchendu. The world has no end, and what is good among one people is an abomination with others. We have albinos among us. Do you not think that they came to our clan by mistake, that they have strayed from their way to a land where everybody is like them?
Okonkwo's first wife soon finished her cooking and set before their guests a big meal of pounded yams and bitter leaf soup. Okonkwo's son, Nwoye, brought in a pot of sweet wine tapped from the raffia palm.
You are a big man now, Obierica said to Nwoye. Your friend, Anene, asked me to greet you.
Is he well?
Asked Nwoye.
We are all well, said Obierica.
Ezinma brought them a bowl of water with which to wash their hands. After that, they began to eat and to drink the wine.
When did you set out from home? Asked Okonkwo.
We had meant to set out from my house before cockcrow, said Obierica. But Nweke did not appear until it was quite light.
Never make an early morning appointment with a man who has just married a new wife. They all laughed.
Has Nweke married a wife? Asked Okonkwo.
He has married Okadigbo's second daughter, said Obierica.
That is very good, said Okonkwo. I do not blame you for not hearing the cock crow.
When they had eaten, Obierica pointed at the two heavy bags.
That is the money from your yams, he said. I sold the big ones as soon as you left. Later on, I sold some of the seed yams and gave out others to sharecroppers. I shall do that every year until you return. But I thought you would need the money now, and so I brought it. Who knows what may happen tomorrow? Perhaps green men will come to our clan and shoot us.
God will not permit it, said Okonkwo. I do not know how to thank you.
I can tell you, said Obierica.
Kill one of your sons for me.
That will not be enough, said Okonkwo.
Then kill yourself, said Obierica.
Forgive me, said Okonkwo, smiling. I shall not talk about thanking you any more.
This ends Disc 4. Things Fall Apart, Disc 5.
Chapter 16. When, nearly 2 years later, Obierica paid another visit to his friend in exile, the circumstances were less happy. The missionaries had come to Umofia. They had built their church there, won a handful of converts, and were already sending evangelists to the surrounding towns and villages. That was a source of great sorrow to the leaders of the clan, but many of them believed that the strange faith and the white man's God would not last. None of his converts was a man whose word was heeded in the assembly of the people. None of them was a man of title. They were mostly the kind of people that were called efulefu, worthless, empty men. The imagery of an efulefu in the language of the clan was a man who sold his machete
and wore the sheath to battle. Chielo, the priestess of Agbala, called the converts the excrement of the clan, and the new faith was a mad dog that had come to eat it up. What moved Obiereka to visit Okonkwo was the sudden appearance of the latter's son, Nwoye, among the missionaries in Umofia. "What are you doing here?" Obiereka had asked when, after many difficulties, the missionaries had allowed him to speak to the boy. "I am one of them," replied Nwoye. "How is your father?" Obiereka asked, not knowing what else to say. "I don't know. He is not my father," said Nwoye, unhappily. And so, Obiereka went to Mbanta to see his friend. And he found that Okonkwo did not wish to speak about Nwoye. It was only from Nwoye's mother that he heard scraps of the story. The arrival of the missionaries had caused a considerable stir in the village of Mbanta. There were six of them, and one was a white man. Every man and woman came out to see the white man. Stories about these strange men had grown since one of them had been killed in Abame, and his iron horse tied to the sacred silk cotton tree. And so everybody came to see the white man. It was the time of year when everybody was at home. The harvest was over. When they had all gathered, the white man began to speak to them. He spoke through an interpreter, who was an Igbo man, though his dialect was different and harsh to the ears of Mbanta. Many people laughed at his dialect and the way he used words strangely. Instead of saying, "myself," he always said, "my buttocks." But he was a man of commanding presence, and the clansmen listened to him. He said he was one of them, as they could see from his color and his language. The other four black men were also their brothers, although one of them did not speak Igbo. The white man was also their brother, because they were all sons of God. And he told them about this new God, the creator of all the world and all the men and women. He told them that they worshipped false gods, gods of wood and stone. A deep murmur went through the crowd when he said this. He told them that the true God lived on high, and that all men, when they died, went before him for judgment. Evil men, and all the heathen who in their blindness bowed to wood and stone, were thrown into a fire that burned like palm oil. But good men, who worshipped the true God, lived forever in his happy kingdom. "We have been sent by this great God to ask you to leave your wicked ways and false gods and turn to him, so that you may be saved when you die," he said. "Your buttocks understand our language," said someone lightheartedly, and the crowd laughed. "What did he say?" the white man asked his interpreter. But before he could answer, another man asked a question. "Where is the white man's horse?" he asked. The Igbo evangelists consulted among themselves and decided that the man probably meant bicycle. They told the white man, and he smiled benevolently. "Tell them," he said, "that I shall bring many iron horses when we have settled down among them. Some of them will even ride the iron horse themselves." This was interpreted to them, but very few of them heard. They were talking excitedly among themselves because the white man had said he was going to live among them. They had not thought about that. At this point, an old man said he had a question. "Which is this God of yours?" he asked. "The goddess of the earth? The god of the sky? Amadiora? Or the thunderbolt? Or what?" The interpreter spoke to the white man, and he immediately gave his answer.
all the gods you have named are not gods at all. They are gods of deceit, who tell you to kill your fellows and destroy innocent children. There is only one true God, and he has the earth, the sky, you and me, and all of us.
If we leave our gods and follow your God, asked another man, who will protect us from the anger of our neglected gods and ancestors?
Your gods are not alive and cannot do you any harm, replied the white man. They are pieces of wood and stone.
When this was interpreted to the men of Mbanta, they broke into derisive laughter. These men must be mad, they said to themselves. How else could they say that Ani and Amadiora were harmless? And Idemili? And Ogugu too? And some of them began to go away. Then the missionaries burst into song. It was one of those gay and rollicking tunes of evangelism which had the power of plucking at silent and dusty chords in the heart of an Igbo man. The interpreter explained each verse to the audience, some of whom now stood enthralled. It was a story of brothers who lived in darkness and in fear, ignorant of the love of God. It told of one sheep out on the hills, away from the gates of God and from the tender shepherd's care. After the singing, the interpreter spoke about the Son of God, whose name was Jesu Christi. Okonkwo, who only stayed in the hope that it might come to chasing the men out of the village or whipping them, now said,
You told us with your own mouth that there was only one God. Now you talk about his son. He must have a wife then.
The crowd agreed. I did not say he had a wife, said the interpreter, somewhat lamely.
Your buttock said he had a son, said the joker. So he must have a wife, and all of them must have buttocks.
The missionary ignored him and went on to talk about the Holy Trinity. At the end of it, Okonkwo was fully convinced that the man was mad. He shrugged his shoulders and went away to tap his afternoon palm wine. But there was a young lad who had been captivated. His name was Nwoye, Okonkwo's first son. It was not the mad logic of the Trinity that captivated him. He did not understand it. It was the poetry of the new religion. Something felt in the marrow. The hymn about brothers who sat in darkness and in fear seemed to answer a vague and persistent question that haunted his young soul. The question of the twins crying in the bush, and the question of Ikemefuna, who was killed. He felt a relief within as the hymn poured into his parched soul. The words of the hymn were like the drops of frozen rain melting on the dry palate of the panting earth. Nwoye's callow mind was greatly puzzled.